You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today gives us our first glimpse of the unlikely peasant boy who is to become King David, the one who was to be the giant slayer, Israel's greatest king, was also known as the Anointed One, or in Hebrew, the Messiah. To give you some background, our story begins at a point when King Saul, Israel's first king, has really become a liability, paranoid, ineffective, and from all appearances, certifiably insane. The prophet Samuel had warned the people against hiring themselves a king, but no one listened. He was worn out from telling them, "I told you so," so he was sitting around sulking. Yahweh slaps Samuel upside the head and says, "Forget the good old days. We got places to go, things to do," and sends Samuel over to a little town called Bethlehem. There he will find the sons of Jesse, one of whom Samuel is to anoint with oil as Yahweh's choice of a new king. This is a story about redefining expectations. And not to put too fine a point on it, what God and Samuel are up to here is called treason, anointing a new king while the old king is still in power. But the story seems to suggest that God wanted to push reset and redefine the definition of king. No one expects who is to be chosen, not even Samuel. I love the dialogue in this passage between Yahweh and Samuel. Samuel says, "Okay, this has got to be the one." God says, "Nope. This one? Nope. This one? Nope." Right on down the line. And who ends up being anointed? A kid who smells of sheep, the last born, a runt from an insignificant town called Bethlehem. Time to adjust your expectations.
Our words of wisdom are from 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 6 through 13a. When they came, Samuel looked on Eliab and thought,
"Surely the Lord's anointed one is before the Lord."
But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord does not see as mortals see. They look on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. He said,
"Neither has the Lord chosen this one."
Then Jesse made Shammah pass by, and then Samuel said,
"Neither has the Lord chosen this one."
Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse,
"The Lord has not chosen any of these."
Samuel said to Jesse,
"Are all your sons here?"
And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, but he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse,
"Send and bring him, for we will not sit down until he comes here."
He sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. The Lord said, "Rise and anoint him, for this is the one." Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the presence of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from the day forward. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
A couple of friends were preparing a roast for dinner when one of them unceremoniously cut an inch off of each end of the meat before putting it in the roasting pan. The friend asked her, "Why are you doing that?" And she said, "That's the way I've always done it. I learned it from my mom." Not satisfied with this answer, the skeptical friend persuaded the other friend to call her mom and ask why she would always cut an inch off of each end of the pot roast. The mother said, "That's the way I've always done it. I learned it from my mom." Well, now it was getting interesting. So all three of them got on a call with the grandmother and asked her why she would always cut an inch off of each end of the pot roast. The grandmother just laughed and said, "You know, we used to be very poor and didn't own a lot of cookware. I would cut the ends off of the meat so it would fit into the only pan that I had." How many things do we do in life for no other reason than that's the way we've always done it? Even long after the original circumstances are long since irrelevant. It often never crosses our mind to question it until we do. Then we have to make some decisions about how to go forward. I'd like you to imagine with me the years right after the crucifixion. It's not a time that is talked about much, but imagine the challenge set before the first followers of Jesus. There are rumors of a resurrection, but nobody tells the same story. Paul won't be writing for another 25 years, and the first synoptic gospel, Mark, won't be written for another 40 plus years. What do we do now? Everyone is basically on their own. What they do know is that many of them committed everything to following this would-be Messiah, and he ends up dead. He ends up falling short of every expectation we had and is a total failure as a Messiah. The rest is rumor and hearsay. What to do indeed? Before we can help answer that question, it might be good to revisit what Messiah means in the first place. The Hebrew word Mashiach, Messiah in English, literally means anointed. That's it. It appears 39 times in all of Hebrew scripture and most often refers to the ruler of Judah or Israel. Case in point is King David, who in our story today is anointed king, therefore becoming the Messiah. According to the Bible's take on things, David's royal line lasted about 400 more years with mixed results. Over time, the term Messiah came to refer less and less to the current occupant of the palace and more to the notion of an ideal king. Then, when the Davidic line was severed at the time of the Babylonian exile, the Messiah became a kind of code word referring to a hoped-for political and military leader who would reclaim the throne, liberate the people from foreign oppressors, and restore the nation to glory. So, cue the confusion. Jesus' life didn't match the historical job description of Messiah, primarily that of the ideal king and conquering hero. He hadn't even been officially anointed, unless you count the occasions on which Jesus has oil administered by women, which would have been another shocking departure from the norm. When you look at the biblical evidence, Jesus never aspired to take on the role of Messiah. In only one place in all the Gospels does Jesus even use messianic language, and that's in Luke's account of Jesus reading Isaiah in the synagogue at Nazareth. Other than that, the disciple Nathanael declared Jesus King of Israel on one occasion, and Matthew's Peter refers to Jesus as Messiah and is quickly shushed by Jesus. And then there's the occasion where Jesus actually ran away from the crowd because he believed they were about to force him into the role of king. But look, people were desperate. Any charismatic person who came along and could conceivably fill the role that the people had been waiting for would, of course, have been encouraged to take the lead in challenging the oppression of their occupiers. And even the disciples got caught up in the excitement and missed what Jesus was up to. But Jesus was not interested in a violent military overthrow of the present kingdom and the establishment of a new one. Jesus' message was that of God's kingdom and that it was already present, like a conspiracy, hidden. Where most people could only imagine a military ruler as the solution, Jesus had a different agenda. He modeled servanthood. He taught a way of forgiveness and peace. And when he was executed, even those who crucified him mocked him with a sign above his head that said, "King of the Jews," because even they knew that in virtually every way, Jesus didn't meet the criteria of the Jews' long-awaited victorious Messiah. So, what do we do with a failed Messiah? Well, some of Jesus' followers declared him to be a Messiah anyway, knowing full well that in order for the term Messiah to be applied to Jesus would require some adjusting of the story in order for the title to apply, even if it meant ignoring what actually happened. The people were looking for a liberator, not a social critic. They were looking for someone to free them from Rome, not free them from sin. The peasants wanted freedom from debt and the oppressive subsistence economics that were being imposed on them. And it was clear that the pre-resurrection Jesus did not fulfill these expectations. But maybe a post-resurrection Jesus just might be able to fulfill the hopes and dreams of the people in a spectacular way. So, within a few years of the crucifixion, the collective memory of Jesus began to undergo a dramatic transformation. Greek-speaking Jewish communities within the Jesus movement began shifting their attention away from the teachings of Jesus and began focusing instead on the spiritual and cosmic significance of Jesus' death and the validation of his true identity through a physical resurrection. This new message spread quickly through the empire. And remember, the language of the empire was Greek, not Hebrew. So it should be no surprise that Greek-speaking followers of Jesus would translate anointed from the Hebrew word Mashiach to the Greek Christos. And based on Luke's telling in Acts, a new religious cult began to develop in Antioch around the figure of the Christos, or the Christ. According to Acts, Antioch was the first place that Jesus' followers were called Christians, and they were convinced that Jesus had been transformed at death into a divine spiritual presence. From that belief came the beginnings of all the theological formulas, rituals, prayers, and hymns that we're still living with today. Not far from Antioch, an earnest young Jew named Saul of Tarsus was first exposed to these ideas. Now, to the Jewish authorities for whom Saul worked, these groups were viewed as a threat. The Sadducees thought that Jesus had been dealt with, but instead, he'd become the focus of a new martyr cult, the growth of which needed to be curbed. Saul was just one of those appointed to undermine this new movement, which included immersing himself in learning about and contemplating the ideas of the new movement. These emerging Christian communities were viewed with suspicion by Roman authorities as well. People were beginning to refer to Jesus with the rudimentary creed, Jesus is Lord. Far from being just a courtesy title, this was seen as a countercultural and insurrectionist statement opposed to the requirement of Roman citizens to confess that Caesar is Lord. At the same time this new Jesus movement was developing, Greek mystery religions were all the rage across the empire. These mystery cults focused on the myths of Demeter, Orpheus, Dionysus, Adonis, Osiris, and Mithras, among others. And what was worshipped about all these characters? Their death and rebirth. Their rituals included rites that led worshipers into ecstatic feelings and promised redemption or salvation in the present and the promise of immortality in an afterlife. Sound familiar? As I've said before, Saul, now Paul, was a marketing genius. He took the ancient traditions and ethics of his own Jewish background and melded it with the emotional and spiritual immediacy of the popular mystery cults and essentially created a new religion that not only bridged ethnic and cultural divides, but had aspirations that appealed to an audience on a global scale. Paul's theological alchemy is an evolution of the Greek idea of dualism, where one's body and soul are separate entities. Overlaying the Greek idea of an eternal soul that continues beyond death with the relatively new idea from Pharisaic Judaism of resurrection from the dead, Paul was basically instrumental in inventing the Christian idea of an afterlife in heaven. And as Paul was writing long before the authors of the Gospels or other books of the New Testament, his ideas shaped everything that was to follow. In the decades following Jesus' death, the predominantly Jewish, Palestinian-centered communities of the Way, or the Gospel of Jesus, declined in influence, and the Hellenistic or Greek mystery cult developed by Paul, the gospel about Jesus, began to dominate the movement. Paul's movement incorporated a blending of Jewish elements like the Passover meal and mikveh-based purification with Greek elements of secret meals and water-based initiation rites. Throw in some Greek-style speaking in tongues, and the cult of the mystical Christ was on a roll. As time went by, miraculous stories of healing and powers over the elements were attributed to Jesus. His teachings were blended with Jewish apocalyptic thought and Greek Gnostic teachings, things that the historical Jesus clearly would have never said were attributed to him as later generations transformed Jesus from a teacher of wisdom, a radical social critic, and voice for justice into an apocalyptic preacher who threatened people with the approach of the end times. Bottom line, to those who had expected Jesus to be a militaristic and nationalist Messiah, Jesus had clearly failed. So, to correct this unrealized expectation, followers claimed that Jesus would return with world-conquering power and would violently destroy all who persecuted those of the new faith. Second-generation followers transformed the nonviolent prophet into an avenging warrior king. So, within a couple of generations, we have an historical Jesus who never claimed to be God, or even the exclusive Son of God, who never claimed to be the Hebrew Messiah or Greek Christ, and who never even made exalted claims about himself, who was utterly transformed. By 325, when the Emperor Constantine convened a council to debate the fundamentals of what was to become Orthodox Christianity, the bishops took a vote and elevated Jesus to divine status. So in the ultimate exclamation point for the gospel about Jesus, Jesus becomes God. So, once again, as 21st century progressive Christians, we're left with a choice. There are really only two options. Number one, we can go with the opposite of what Jesus taught, the gospel about Jesus, which is the choice that the historical church has made. Or, number two, we could go with what Jesus taught, the gospel of Jesus. Now, this is complicated because to do so not only means having to reject the idea of Messiah as a violent, militaristic ruler, which takes away the need for all the apocalyptic second coming nonsense many Christians are addicted to, but also means we have to reevaluate all the ways the gospel about Jesus has obscured what Jesus was really teaching. Look, taking into consideration what we know from the Bible, the life of the historic Jesus of Nazareth ended in a humiliating defeat on a rebel's cross, a reality that many in the early Jesus movement couldn't accept. He was a failed Messiah. So what do you do with a failed Messiah? As Dom Crossan describes it, well-meaning followers proceeded to give Jesus an upgrade to keep him in line with the kind of narrative that people expected. We need to keep asking, why are you cutting the ends off of the roast? Right? If the historical Jesus said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, why would we give any credibility to the vision in the book of Revelation where Jesus is riding a war horse through the streets full of blood, executing those who don't worship him? If the historical Jesus went out of his way to welcome the outcast and feed those of other religions as beloved children of God, why would we take seriously those who exclude and condemn non-Christians because Jesus is somehow the only way? If the historical Jesus seems to have willingly gone to his death at the hands of the Romans, Why do we continue to be seduced by the gospel about Jesus, claiming that Jesus' death was about settling some cosmic debt or about satiating God's lust for the blood of an innocent victim? Doesn't it make more sense that the humble and nonviolent Jesus was making a statement about the cost of following him? I like what John Dominic Crossan and others have suggested. Dom says, when you picture Jesus dying on the cross, it's a message to us. It's saying, you've been warned, plain and simple. It's a warning that this is the way the violent, oppressive, militaristic status quo treats anyone who questions them. This is what living the gospel of Jesus may take. So be ready. The life and teachings of the historical Jesus were all about unraveling people's expectations and of confronting the status quo. And from the very beginning, Jesus' first followers didn't even get it. When they perceived Jesus to have failed as the Messiah they expected, they didn't stop and think, maybe we should re-examine our expectations. No, instead, they quickly amended the story to bring the Jesus story in line with what they expected. So that leaves us with a huge task before us. We need to not only be aware that the gospel of Jesus is in constant danger of being overwhelmed by the gospel about Jesus in our everyday lives. We need to stay alert to how, even in the Bible itself, the gospel about Jesus is working to fumigate the gospel of Jesus. Wherever you find evidence of the historical Jesus conspiracy of love in the text, embrace it and put it to work in your life. And wherever the dominating, competitive, exclusive gospel about Jesus surfaces, take thou authority to boldly ask, hey, why are you cutting the ends off the roast? Don't be afraid to question the things that don't make sense. There are so many elements of the practice of Christianity that conflict with the life and teachings of Jesus. It's going to take all of us working together and putting love first to make the changes that need to be made to realize the vision that Jesus has cast for a healed and whole world. May the Spirit be with us as we go. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.